Good morning.
Good morning.
So yesterday I commented on Master Humjur's he called it the something of pure bliss.
Excuse me, Sojourn, can you name what text you're speaking from for people?
Cultivating the Empty Field that I used during the...
some of the people...
I know, practice rate, thank you. So, the guidelines... guidelines for the whole of pure bliss. So, when we study someone like Humjur, who speaks in this way about illumination, silent illumination, and bliss, and so forth, it can be construed maybe that this is a kind of flowery, idealistic way of speaking about something. But actually, this is just very down to earth. From my perspective, this is just totally down to earth about our actual true life. And because we pay so much attention to the confused life around us, this seems extraordinary. But if you think about what is ordinary and what is extraordinary, what seems extraordinary is actually the ordinary. But we don't often, we doubt the ordinary. we doubt the ordinary and think of it as extraordinary or something outside of our experience or outside of the usual. But, there's a talk from Suzuki Roshi, which we titled Letters from Emptiness, Receiving a Letter from Emptiness, where, receiving a letter from emptiness, there's a word for this in Japanese, which I don't remember, but receiving email from home, not email, receiving mail from home, receiving a letter from home. It's like you hear about what people are doing and how they're feeling and how the plants are doing and the spring feeling and so forth, but it's not exactly your experience. You're experiencing the feeling of someone sending the letter. But it corresponds to some feeling that you already have because you've been there. And you've experienced the home, right? It's your home. But you're somewhat removed from that place. And so when someone gives a talk or expresses this kind of understanding, it's kind of like a letter from emptiness, a letter from your old home, which you recognize as something from your distant past or something that is very close to you, but it's reminding you of your own experience. When I read Ko'un Ejo's immersion in the treasury of light, at the very end, he says, "You won't. If you really understand this, you won't doubt it. It'd be just like meeting your grandfather in the town, and recognizing who he is." So, then in the same talk, Suzuki Roshi talks about an artist or artists, you know, who contrive and work hard to create something wonderful and artistic. And he said, I love to make a small rock garden, but when I go down to the creek, I see how futile that is. I'd much rather just take the trash out of the creek, you know, take the branches out and reveal what's really there. So this is what actually Hong Jir is talking about, and what all the ancestors are talking about. Just take the trash out of the creek and reveal what's there. And this is what he's simply talking about. Clean it up. Clean up your act so you can see what's there. Because it's all covered up. So there's also the feeling of, well, since it's all always there, since this, what we call, divine light or whatever you want to call it, is always there, then we should always be experiencing that. But that's not necessarily so. Dogen says, when he went to China, he had this, of course, as you know, this question, if it's already there, why do we have to do anything? Why don't we just experience this? Why isn't it this, you know, just part of our ordinary ordinary understanding or ordinary experience? And then when he got to China, he realized that unless you turn the wheel, unless you practice, it doesn't manifest. So is it always manifesting or is it not always manifesting? It's always manifesting, but unless we do something to realize it, it doesn't manifest. That's how Dogen, that's the basis of Dogen's practice, which he's, in which he wrote the 100 fascicles of the Shobo Gensho, and plus many other things. That's the real basis. How it becomes accessible, how your treasure store, which everyone has, becomes accessible. So, although it seems like Hong Jir is putting a lot of emphasis on letting go and simply, you know, facing the bright window, but he also talks about taking care of the daily circumstances of our life. So we should realize that as well. I was going to read another talk of Hong Jir about the meaning of silent illumination, but then I got interested in Suzuki Roshi's Letters from Emptiness, and then I got interested in Brown Rice is Just Right. And this is a work in progress, of course. But I think the Brown Rice is Just Right is so good and so relevant to so many things that I will talk about that today. So when Suzuki Roshi came to America, I've talked about this many times and you probably remember it. When he came to America, of course, he was used to eating white rice. And all, you know, Japanese people eat white rice. Asian people eat white rice. Brown rice is low class. if you know, pigs eat it and stuff like that. So. But Americans, as Americans, you know, We love brown rice, and it's good for you. And then you get beriberi. Yeah, beriberi was a disease that came in Asia that was came from eating too much white rice without balancing it with other things. Anyway, so there were many things that we ate that he ate too. And he saw the good qualities of brown rice, and probably how he, you know, how we killed him. But I hate to say that. But here he talks about the wonderful spiritual qualities of brown rice. He says, how do you like zazen? I think it may be better to ask, how do you like brown rice? Zazen is too big a topic, because brown rice is just right. Actually, there's not much difference between brown rice and zazen. When you eat brown rice, you have to chew it, and unless you chew it, it's difficult to swallow. When you chew it very well, your mouth becomes part of the kitchen, and actually the brown rice becomes more and more tasty. Part of the kitchen, it's a little funny statement, you know, but there's a saying that a monk's mouth is like a kitchen. You know, you just, whatever comes, you put it in there. without complaining. I have to complain, but when we eat white rice, we don't chew it so much. But that little bit of chewing feels so good that naturally the rice goes down, goes easily right down our throats. So, you know, he says this is the nice quality of white rice. You don't have to chew it so much, and it goes down, and you like it. But brown rice, you really have to chew it in order for it to reveal itself. When we digest food completely, what will become of it? It will be transformed, changing its chemical nature, and will permeate our whole body. So, in a sense, the kitchen part is like, in the kitchen, you take something raw and you prepare it, you cook it, and then it comes out as something different. We change its nature from raw material into food. And here, when we digest food completely, what will become of it? It will be transformed, changing its chemical nature, and will permeate our whole body. In the process, it dies within our body. To eat and digest food is natural to us, but as we always, we are always changing the organic. To eat and digest food is natural to us, as we are always changing. This organic process is called emptiness. The reason we call it emptiness is that it has no special form. It has some form, but that form is not permanent. While it is changing, it carries on our life. So, this process of change is what creates the vitality for our life. So, dying, it dies within our body, but the dying is not what we think of as dying. It's changing the process to become, to release the energy. So when we talk about birth and death, living and dying, it's more of a process of changing the energy to release energy so that there's continuation. So if we think that we were born and then we die and that's it is very short-sighted. Just to think that we exist is short-sighted. So we, you know, our understanding is always on the surface. Well, someone like Hung Jir is bringing up the essential. And so it's hard to swallow, no pun intended, sometimes, what is essential. And it looks like dreaming or something, but actually it's the reality which exposes the dreaming. In another talk, Suzuki Roshi talked about the way the Japanese people eat, you know, is a little bit here, a little bit there, and maybe five or six things on the plate, and each one is has its own character. It's like little people, you know, each one has a name and, you know, and a form, and it's recognized, and that's a very wonderful way to eat. What we do is mix all our food together. Not all of it, of course, but there's a tendency to mix things together and to create wonderful dishes by mixing things together. They also mix things together, but it's different, you know. So you eat a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and it has its character, but when it enters into your tummy, as he says, it loses its character or its characteristics. And this is the difference between light and dark. In the darkness, all of those individual pieces which are revealed in the light lose their character and become one. It's like water returns to the source. In the Shuso ceremony, when the Shuso brings back the Shippe to the abbot, after the Shuso ceremony, the Shuso says, water returns to the source. It's a wonderful statement. So, we know that we are empty, and also this earth is empty. The forms are not permanent. You may wonder, what is this universe? But the universe has no limit. Emptiness is not something you can understand through a space trip. Emptiness can be understood when you are perfectly involved in chewing rice. This is actual emptiness. You know, we reach, sometimes feel that in order to have knowledge, we need to reach far and wide. And the further we go, the more information we have. And the more information we have, the less we know. Are we on the right track? Maybe. That's one way. It's a kind of roundabout way of understanding, which is important. But how do you understand how do we understand what's right here in front of us? How do we understand the transformative process which is right in front of us, which we're involved in all the time? The usual, ordinary, what we think of as ordinary, which is so extraordinary. The most important point is to establish yourself in a true sense without establishing yourself on delusion. And yet, we cannot live or practice without delusion. Delusion is what we usually think of as ordinary. Delusion is necessary, but it's not something on which you can establish yourself. This is how we get lost. It's like a stepladder. Within it, you cannot climb up, but you don't stay on the stepladder. With this confidence, you can continue to study our way That is why I say, don't run away. Don't, you know, stay with me. I don't mean stick to me. I mean stick to yourself and not with delusion. So, sometimes I may be a delusion. You may overestimate me. Oh, he is a good teacher. That's already a kind of delusion. I am just your friend, just practicing with you as your friend who has many stepladders or ways of helping you. We shouldn't be disappointed with a bad teacher or with a bad student. So this is really important. We shouldn't be disappointed with a bad teacher or with a bad student. You know, if we like something, we take it up. If we don't like something, you know, we push it away. But we have to get beyond what is good and what is bad. We have to get beyond what is like and what is dislike. Sometimes I hear people say, well, I don't like so-and-so, or I like so-and-so, I don't like. That's in a superficial way, that may be okay, but in a fundamental way, they're totally off. For a teacher, it doesn't matter whether you like somebody or don't like somebody. It has nothing to do with it. If you base your relationship on whether you like or don't like, it has nothing to do with it. People say sometimes, don't you have any someone who's close to you that you can, you know, express yourself to? I say, no, I don't. I don't have anyone close or far. Everyone's the same. Although everyone's different. But it's not a matter of like or dislike or intimacy or lack of intimacy. Simply addressing everyone equally. So, you know, if a bad teacher and a bad student strive for the truth, something real will be established. That is our zazen. We must continue to practice zazen and continue to chew brown rice. Eventually, we will accomplish something. If a bad student and a bad teacher work together. He didn't say anything good about anybody here. Thank goodness. I don't choose my friends. Sometimes we have to ask somebody to leave. But it doesn't mean that we like or don't like the person. It's just too much trouble. Drawing too much attention, someone who draws too much attention to themselves or is not up to being able to practice or is too crazy to deal with because they absorb too much energy. But as far as like and dislike, preference should have nothing to do with it. Otherwise, we just skirting the surface of things. So, you know, this is the letter from emptiness. The letter from emptiness is giving us some way to express emptiness as form. If we really want to understand or experience emptiness, the only way to do that is through form. Q chewing brown rice, if you chew it thoroughly and digest it, he's really talking about our practice. He's not talking about brown rice. He's talking about how you experience your practice. If it's too easy, it just goes down too fast, and there's no nourishment there. But if you really take it on and chew it thoroughly, then it's nourishing, spiritually nourishing. We have body nourishment, emotional nourishment, but there's spiritual nourishment. Spiritual nourishment is through practice, and especially through Zazen. And this is what Hongjir is talking about all the time. It's just there, just open the door and nourish yourself, because it's self-nourishing. Practice is self-nourishing. Do you have any questions? Alan?
I was thinking about what you were saying about Japanese cuisine, and also it applies to our oryoki eating, which is similar. And then what I've experienced in a lot of the South Asian monastic traditions, which they carry this big bowl, that's like their belly.
Mm-hmm.
And everything goes into it, and it's all mixed up in advance, and they don't pick and choose. That doesn't happen all the time, but it happens. It's pretty common. So all the food is just—it's already pre-blended in some way.
Well, this is monastic food.
Yes, but oryoki is also monastic food.
Right. It's a different way of, there's a sutra, Pali sutra. About different characteristics of people. There's the types. There's the delusive type, the angry type, greedy type, and I think there are four. Angry. No, delusive.
It's three. Yeah.
Yeah. The delusive type. One of the characteristics of the delusive type is that they mix all their food together and mush it all up. So there's no characteristic to it. But you know, we don't have to be attached to that understanding. The greedy type is very delicate with their food, you know, and very particular about it. Like me.
Can you talk about how delusion is important for practice?
Well, we can't live without it. You know, delusive means being tricked, you know, it's the magic show. You think this is happening, but it's just a magic show, you know. And the magician can really fool you into thinking that where'd the rabbit go, you know, and where'd it come from? And it looks like it's really happening. And also, it's also characterized by a sparkler. You know, the sparkler is just a piece of, like a stick with a little punk, not even a flame, right? But a little red. And but when you go like this, it makes a circle. And you say, oh, that's a circle. But it's really not a real circle. It's a circle for that a moment, right? So we live in this momentary circle of light. But it's not what it seems to be. But we live here anyway. So we live in a dualistic world. And that's where our life takes place. So we have to, we can't avoid that. This is the characteristic. The characteristic of this world is that it's dualistic and momentary. But in order to create a stability, we create a magic world, a magic city, and believe in it. So we go through the motions, or we go through the activity within the magic city, but the wisdom, if you have wisdom, you see it that way. If you don't, then you're totally in delusion.
If the qualities of the delusive mind that allow us to get through the world, you were saying, can be transformed in the great mirror wisdom so that you can identify a quality, you can identify difference.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the functions that let us get through life, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we are trapped in delusion.
No, so just being trapped in delusion. So delusion is necessary. In other words, wherever you are, it's necessary to be there. Right? you find yourself in a situation. You're born in a certain place at a certain time with all these things going on. So you have to live there. So that's necessary. You have to breathe and work and move around and all these things. So that's, it is the delusive world. But we live in the delusive world in an enlightened way. So samsara and nirvana are not two.
Said, I think I heard you say that the transformative process is always going on. Transformation
yeah.
is always going on. And what came up for me is that includes when I'm asleep, literally asleep, I get my head down and lose consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, is there some way I should be trying to, or practicing when I'm asleep?
Well, you know, practicing sleep is to be totally asleep. Totally asleep. No dreams. That's practicing sleep. I mean, of course, dreams are okay, you know, it's like being awake. Dreams are okay. We're dreaming when we're awake, and we're dreaming when we're asleep. It's really going to sleep and being awake are really just two sides of the same thing, in reverse. But you want to be conscious of being asleep, right? But that's you don't need to be conscious of being asleep.
That's my
because
question.
Consciousness is on the side of delusion.
So thinking there's something to do. Is on the side of delusion?
Yes. Thinking there's something to do is on the side of delusion.
So thinking I should go to the Zendo, is that on the side of delusion?
Yes, but it's okay. I won't deny that. But it's an enlightened thought within delusion. When we sit Zazen, we're sitting Zazen within delusion. So it's not right to say, well, now that I'm sitting Zazen, there's no delusion. Or I'm separating myself from delusion. No. We're sitting down in the right in the middle of delusion, sitting Zazen. That's what you do moment by moment throughout your life if you're practicing.
Then the same could be said for when I put my head down on the pillow and lose consciousness.
Yeah, that's the real enlightenment.
So can we all go have a nap then?
Well, you know, you take a nap whether you want one or not. I mean, whether you decide or not. And it's very common in the Zendo. You just find yourself somewhere. It's like when you were born. You just find yourself somewhere. And just when Hengzhir talks about the circle of wonder, right? That's like waking up and finding yourself somewhere. How did I get here? We think we know where we are. You know, we think we know where we are. But when we enter the circle of wonder and wake up, wow, what is this place? So, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm kind of interested in this whole issue of liking and not liking other
people.
Beings.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we understand the beings are empty and can arise or can arise spontaneously in situations, then when these, and people are so, and everybody knows that because their kids can be very different when they're home and when they're away and so forth. So is it our job, when aversion comes up, to change the condition which is us? In other words, as a teacher, do you then become a condition? Do you consciously become a condition that should bring forth another being that helps the arising of another being?
Meaning yourself or the other person?
Well, both.
Well, you know.
You can only arise, you can only be another being yourself, I guess.
I can't say, you know, it's tricky, but the bottom line is to be open and unassuming. Assumption creates problems. Mm-hmm. To be open and unassuming, and to, you know, all my life, when I have found myself in aversion to somebody, almost inevitably they end up being my best friend. Maybe not best friend, sometimes. But there's something about turning that aversion into something else. And I just can think of so many people that's happened with. So, and sometimes, you know, a difficult person, I have some aversion, you know, but there's some curiosity, you know, like, why can't I be friends with this person? Why can't I do that, you know? So that's more of a, to me, the challenge of doing that is more interesting than running away or, you know, avoiding or something.
Yeah, my experience is that whenever I shine the light back at myself, I see that I have the same traits as these people.
Well, yeah.
That I have aversion to.
And so often, the people that we have aversion to are so much like us that we have our characteristics that we don't want to look at. And so, you know, this is so common. I mean, so common. So for me, the challenge is, like, how can I, you know, how can I do this? And so I realized that I like taking on difficult people. Difficult people and difficult dogs. It's just, you know, what makes life interesting.
So, Jen, it's 11 now?
It's 11:02.
Yeah. So, when you schedule to end at 11?
I think you're right.
I know I'm not.
Well, now, wait a minute.